Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Our speaker tonight is our teacher, Les. Welcome, Les. I understand you have a title, Our Most Treasured Possession. Is that the title of your talk tonight?
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Oh, good evening, everyone. Our most treasured possession. You might recognize a lot of what I'd like to speak about tonight. I think you might agree that in the modern world, or what we call the developed world, such as in the United States and in Europe, the emphasis for most people's lives is their possessions, both material possessions and emotional possessions. And these possessions that we keep our eye on are, you know, equated with and connected to our sense of satisfaction. They're equated to our survival, to our happiness. So in the modern world, we are constantly in searching for and pursuing possessions. But even though we are pretty good at gaining possessions, what we've learned in the last century or so is that having possessions does not necessarily give us peace of mind. Instead, and within the last century, we've learned that seeking for possessions, not only does that seeking not give us peace of mind, instead it brings us anxiety. Even when we are successful at obtaining possessions. And this lack of peace of mind, you know, creates doubts and questions about life. And I always think about the Buddha legend, the Buddha story. And we all know that as the son of a king of a small kingdom, the Buddha had everything. He had skills and he had good looks and he had wealth and he had love and he had a wonderful family, just about everything you can imagine. And yet, in his mid-20s or so, some kind of doubts arose in his mind about his life and the life he was leading. He felt that his life was incomplete and something was missing. And today we would describe that as a crisis of confidence. Having everything, having many things to be grateful for, and yet not feeling right about it. But he did have this crisis of confidence, and it was so strong that he gave up his possessions. He gave up holding on to possessions and he gave up pursuing them. So he gave up his family. He gave up his privileges. And he gave up all the comforts of a royal prince. And as we know from the story, he instead chose a very, very simple life. He lived in nature and he spent much of his time in meditation. And his story relates to us that through his selfless effort, he obtained understanding, what we normally term as enlightenment. He obtained understanding and he obtained confidence. He no longer doubted what his life was about, what its meaning was, and what he was doing with it. He had confidence after giving up possessions. So the point of the Buddha story is that happiness is not about having possessions. Happiness is a feeling of confidence that we have, which goes beyond the personal. Happiness is not about our status or about our fame or about any wealth we might accumulate or about our beauty, because those things change. Those things of our everyday life change. And so our personal confidence can go up or down depending upon the status of our wealth, our fame, and other things. But our spiritual confidence is always steady. Our personal confidence, the confidence we have in the possessions that we gain about our everyday life, can change. But spiritual confidence is steady. It never changes. And the reason is, as we learn from our practice and our teachings, because our spiritual confidence arises because we have given up grasping. We practice selflessness. We understand there is no separation between us and all sentient beings, and we feel our inherent oneness. So our spiritual confidence that Buddha obtained comes from understanding our life, the purpose of our life, and how to live it. And spiritual confidence also includes the joy of being alive and being part of something very big, something that has no limits. Our life can be called successful when we have spiritual confidence. And when it does come to us, we find that we don't hold back in our activities, in our relationships, and we don't hold back when we are given opportunities to do something useful or helpful or creative. And when we find our spiritual confidence, we are not stopped by ideas of failure. We are not stopped by ambiguities and uncertainties. Spiritual confidence gives us the energy to do things, to want to be involved in the world. But a lack of spiritual confidence, we will feel limited. We will feel our life is limited, and we will feel ourselves as limited. And a lack of spiritual confidence, we will lead a life of caution, as if there are enemies lurking everywhere. So spiritual confidence comes from our vision, our spiritual vision, from knowing who we are inherently. Spiritual confidence comes from a ready mind, an empty mind, and a wide mind, which we can all say is a mind without delusion. The spiritual vision that we have enables us to see the big picture in our daily life. And it is important to understand what we call the big picture. It has a sense of what that means and what it is. And the big picture covers everything. It is everywhere. And it will instruct us and inform us and enable us to appreciate how to take care of any situation and how to go about resolving any problem in our daily life, whether it's in politics or business, whether it's legal or medical, or has to do with our family, or just something very personal. But if we don't have the big picture, we will be overwhelmed by surprises. And we will make mistakes that could have been avoided. And it happens in all types of relationships with people and with things. We need a ready mind to see the big picture. Otherwise, our mind will have a very narrow view of our life. And when we have a big mind, we never assume that we do have the entire big picture. We never make that assumption about what we see and understand. That's a kind of arrogance. So with a big mind, rather than feeling that we have the big picture, instead of making that assumption or have that belief, we simply keep a wide view and keep our awareness working wherever we are, whatever we do. So with a ready mind, with spiritual confidence, our awareness is always active, like a radar, always open to something new, willing to adjust when there are changes, willing to adjust without resistance. And that's a reflection of our spiritual confidence. When we have a big picture attitude, we are always master of ourself. We are always taking care of ourself and everything around us from inside. In other words, we don't depend on receiving help from outside. And this is very succinctly illustrated by a saying that is attributed to Joshu. He said, "The one word which I dislike to hear is Buddha." And he didn't like examples of when people would tell him, "Oh, the Buddha said this and the Buddha said that." Joshi said, "I don't want to hear what Buddha said. Don't tell me what Buddha said. Tell me what you say." So with that kind of attitude, we can take care of ourselves. In our everyday life, we often, or maybe even usually, feel like we are dependent on our boss or our customers or the doctors we visit. We're dependent on what others think of us. There are many things that we feel that our life is dependent on. But actually, our life is dependent only on our spiritual self-confidence, which is beyond any notion of dependent or independent. This attitude of internal self-confidence is a picture of Buddha. And when we have it, everything is practice. There are no distinctions. We recognize that inherently there are no distinctions. For example, building a beautiful temple is exactly the same as cleaning the bathroom. Somebody may ask, if everyone is enlightened, why do you have to build a temple? Or if there's no distinction between clean and dirty, why do we clean the bathroom? We do it because it is our practice of taking care. It is an expression of our spiritual self. Forty years ago, when we decided to create the Kanando we have today, when we decided we should create a larger Zendo and a larger center, it was not because we felt, oh, people need this, or this will help spread Buddhism. That would be a misunderstanding. So people may be happy to have the Kanando we have today as a place to practice, and maybe Zen practice and Buddhism will spread because there's a Kanando. But we created Kanando without any idea of gain or accomplishment. We felt confident in the building of it, just in doing the work. Our confidence did not come about because we were achieving some goal. When we reflect, or when we examine or become aware of how we're doing, when we study ourselves, like Dogen said, and we discover that we don't totally have 100% big picture. You know, we may look at ourselves and say, gee, I don't have a very wide understanding. We don't have to be concerned whether we have 100% of the big picture or not. Doesn't make any difference. We don't worry about that. We just simply continue our attitude of doing things with mindfulness. And that is the big mind. And as we know from our continued Zazen practice, you know, as we continue our Zazen practice, once in a while we notice that the picture is getting bigger. And knowing that we may never have a 100% big picture of our life or of the world, it means that sometimes we wait to do something. We're cautious because we don't want to do something with a narrow mind. We don't want to do something before it's time. So we make our best effort to get as much of the big picture as we can, and then we go ahead with our activity. And if something new or something surprising appears, we simply expand our big picture with our big mind. And this is our practice. We are always watching our small mind. We are always watching our small self. And we notice when we have a small mind. So if we practice, if we sincerely practice Zazen, if we are committed, if we commit to ourselves to watch ourselves carefully, we don't need to feel badly when we forget to do something, we forget somebody's name, when we make a mistake, we don't need to feel badly. Because the true definition of doing something correctly is to have a sincere attitude. And eventually, if we continue that attitude and don't feel badly if we make a mistake, to simply continue to make our best effort, eventually people will notice and they will want to learn. Sometimes we may do something that disturbs others or disturbs someone. And when we recognize it, when we acknowledge it, we acknowledge our relationship with others by either fixing the situation or removing the disturbance or apologizing or saying, excuse me, or maybe all three. And then we can continue to move forward with a big mind without any sense of guilt. So part of our practice is to keep, always try to have a big picture of any situation in order to ensure that we do not disturb the minds of others. To keep a big picture means we don't let our minds close down. We never really say, oh, I'm finished with that. That's enough of working on that. We never assume that we're totally finished. We always stay open and accepting to whatever might need to be taken care of. This is the essence of a giving mind. This is the essence of spiritual confidence. There's a short story from the 8th century China. The teacher was Dao Wu, and his student was Lung Tan. And Lung Tan came from a very poor family who earned their livelihood by making pastries and selling it in the town. And Tao Wu had a little bit of space in his hut. So he allowed Lung Tan's family to stay with him. And in gratitude, Lung Tan gave to Tao Wu some of the cakes, some of the pastries that he made every day. And Tao Wu always returned one, saying, this is my gift to you, to prosper your descendants. And Long Tan thought there was some kind of secret meaning when Tao Wu gave him back one of the pastries. He thought there was some hidden meaning behind it. And so he asked, why? Why do you do that? Tao Wu said, what wrong is there to restore to you what originally belongs to you? This, I think, is an expression of spiritual confidence. Our practice is about restoring our big mind, restoring our big picture mind. Our practice is about restoring spiritual confidence with a giving mind. Does anybody have a question? Diane.
Thank you, Les. I'm going back to what you were saying about possessions. We all have lots of material things. Certainly I do. And I enjoy my material things. And the sense that maybe you should give up all material things and just live a bare bones life. But yet, maybe it's our attitude about our possessions and how we hang on to them, or how we try to have meaning through our possessions. It's hard to sort that out. You know, we live in homes. I like my nice home. Should I give it up and live in a hut somewhere? That's not going to be the answer either, certainly. Is it making our identity tied up with our possessions, or hanging on to them, or only finding meaning through them? Anyway, that's kind of my question about stuff. We're surrounded by stuff, and sometimes it can be a burden, actually.
I think the resolution to your dilemma or your question lies in having an attitude of letting go. You know, you're right that not all of us can live the way Buddha did, or the monks of the 8th century China did, with alone in a hut with no possessions. They could do it because they let go. They stopped grasping. There's a wonderful short story. I forget who the characters are, but it's a monk or a teacher. He's accosted. He's in his hut one night, and a robber comes in, and he takes everything. And as he runs away, the monk says, I wish I could have given him that moon. Mm-hmm. You know, if we have that kind of attitude, you know, I can give away anything. You say to yourself, I can give away anything. No problem. Then we can live a regular life in the everyday world with that attitude. Mm-hmm. So it's not so much in the act of giving up everything and going to live in the forest. It's keeping with us an attitude of of giving up, taking care. And that's our practice. And that's how we bring the practice into the world, into our lives. Let go, let go. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Les. I was curious during your talk, and thank you for a really interesting talk. How do you see the relationship between spiritual confidence and bodhisattva mind? Are they just two terms that might be the same thing? At the end, it seemed like that's what you were saying, or kind of, but I was just curious about how you saw that.
Yes, it's just another way to talk about bodhisattva mind.
At the beginning, I was feeling like it was two different things, that I'm trying to cultivate spiritual confidence, but I don't have... If there's a way in which that kind of attitude can lead to more selfishness in a way. And then as you made your arc of your story and it ended, where it ended up was seemed pretty clear that spontaneously the same spirit. Thank you. The nuts and bolts of it are interesting it's up to me to just thinking about maybe there's a point where we're not thinking of others, or we are involved in kind of a selfish practice, but that it's if it's done with a good teacher and a good framework, we find our way out of that. That kind of impasse, or really, really appreciated the journey that you took us on.
Okay, good to see you. Good to see you, Phil. Oh, hi, Dave.
Hi, Les. Thank you so much for your talk. There's so much to absorb there. There was one thing in particular that you said that really resonated for me. I've had a lifelong passion for reading and learning about science, particularly about things that are very, very big or very, very small or very, very old. And I've never really tried to sort of psychoanalyze my feeling about that. But I have noticed something that happens sometimes when this comes up in conversations, which is that many people feel quite uncomfortable about these things. They say, it makes me feel small and insignificant, like I don't matter. And I really feel uncomfortable thinking about that stuff. And it's just about the exact opposite of the way I feel about it. And the way I feel about it really resonated with what you said about spiritual confidence arising from the joy of being part of something without limits. And I always sort of suspect that the reason that some people find the contemplation of things that are very big or very small or very old to be scary is because they're so attached to their own limitations that they have to compare those to the limitless universe, and they find it so intimidating and so frightening. But thank you for pointing out that the thing to do there is not to ignore the limitless universe, but to see yourself as a part of it and let go of those limits that we clutch on so strongly. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Dave.
So I guess my question is about spiritual confidence. And the idea that I'm asking about is, how do you know whether you're being pulled in a direction that's motivated by a practice of care versus something that's self-aggrandizing and like contributes to your sense of self? I feel like that's, I don't know, always a danger. And I'm not sure how to know from the outset. Most of the time I find out afterwards, and that's not as helpful. Yeah.
So how do you know when the wind is blowing?
Well, I guess you can feel it. I'm not sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. When the wind is blowing, you don't have to ask, is the wind blowing? You feel it. So the same is true with spiritual confidence. And whether we are caring or not, or whether we are grasping or not, we pay attention. And we pay attention to ourselves and we learn. So the paradox is that, our senses can tell us about the environment we're in. It's either cold or hot or raining or windy. Our senses tell us. But it's sometimes difficult for our mind to know the same thing because the mind is not as open as our senses are. If you walk in the forest and a bird sings, you immediately hear the bird. You immediately hear the bird. Your ears have no problem hearing the bird. But sometimes somebody may come to you with perhaps a troubled look on their face. And we may not notice it because we are so wrapped up in ourself. So that's our practice, to have our mind be as attentive and alert and as sensitive as the physical parts of our nature. So that there's no separation. This is our practice. And like you say in your chat, only to find that I was motivated by, something. You found out something. But how, and your last question, how can I know this isn't the case before I set out? Well, you pay attention. Nobody can inform you except you about how you're feeling and any attachments you might have. This is our practice. Thank you.
Good morning.
Hi, Giuseppe. Good morning.
Hello. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you for the talk. I heard your talk as an invitation or strong invitation to wake up to our sincerity, to look at ourselves. In everyday moment, everyday life. sometimes there is a different, and I think that's very Zen. It's not different from the stories of the 8th century of the masters directly telling their students, look, it's nothing you need, just be present, do your best, be alive sincerely. But the Zen practice is also sometimes instead for all of us, it's just a body-mind practice. Go sit with our body, with our mind, and hold our small self in a with our body mind in our zazen, and really practice being a larger self. So these are two different ways of going about practice, or talking about practice, or inviting people to practice. Shall we focus more on one or the other, more on the just like do the practice, you know, physically and with all your mind, our meditation practice. Don't even think about what you get with it. Just stay with your body mind, or more the way you talked about it. I noticed that sometimes today it seems like we associate Zen more to this type of body-mind practice and mindfulness rather than this strong intent, strong determination, for which you need not much more than that. So how do you see these two things? Are two ways, or should we regard them as are two different ways? One way is good, the other way is good, they're both good, or you don't even see a difference between them.
When we are living our life in accordance with our practice and with when we're living according to what we firmly believe is the truth, and we are consistently examining that belief about what is truth, continually clarifying it, when we take our practice into our life with that kind of mind, that spiritual practice, the kind of practice that has no grasping, then everything we do is an invitation. Everything we do is a gift. Without saying to ourselves, oh, now I'm being a good guy today, so I'm giving a gift. We don't do that. We just try to be as clear as we can, try to be selfless as we can and as ungrasping as we can. And when we live that way, then everything we do is a gift and an invitation. Whether other people will notice it or not, we don't know. We just do it. So, you know, we all know the term Zen mind, beginner's mind. I feel it's equivalent to what I would call gift-giving mind. So let's make everything an invitation and everything a gift. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Les.
Hey.
Good to see you.
Nice to see you.
Thank you for your talk. And you talk about assumptions. I remember a while ago, you mentioned that clear up my assumptions. That's definitely associated with arrogance, which is I'm fully aware right now. I was wondering that for any belief system, including science, including math, physics, chemistry, literature, you know, poet, any system, there is an assumption, right? In the very first beginning, to construct the system, there has to be assumption. But however, as long as we have the assumption, we lost the touch of our spiritual confidence. Is that true? I guess my question is, if we want to construct this relative world that's all human beings perceive that to be meaningful, but actually there's nothing in it. But we have to construct the world on top of assumption. That was in vain, actually, but we have to do it. We can't help it. But does this act of construct relative world itself, we're far away from the spiritual confidence, or this spiritual confidence always in us, even though we constantly build upon this virtual world with assumptions? Sorry about that.
Waiting to be expressed.
I guess I'm reading the spiritual confidence and assumption. Are they always together? Because we have to have assumptions.
If we are always prepared to test our assumptions, like in the technical world or the problem-solving world, you know, and Dave could talk to this better than, and Giuseppe also, being in the engineering world, sometimes we're faced with a problem that's very confusing. And in order to try to solve it, we make an assumption about it or about what might work. But if we're ready to let go of the assumption, then we're okay. But if we're stubborn about holding on to it, that's a problem. And everybody has probably seen that happen. I know I have. You're working with somebody to solve a problem, and they are so pleased with their initial assumption that was so exciting, you know? And you say, well, you know, we ought to look at that a little bit more. Maybe they get upset. So we have to be ready to let go of our assumptions if we learn something that should cause us to change what we originally assumed was true. And if we have that kind of spirit and that kind of attitude, ready to reconsider what we originally thought was true, there is confidence in that. There is spiritual confidence in that. You know, I'm ready to give up. You know, I'm confident. I'm ready to give up what I thought was wonderful. That's very confident.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hernan.
Yeah. Hi, Les.
Hi, Hernan.
Good to see you.
I'm glad to see you.
Thank you for the talk. I just wanted to make a small question and then a comment from a movie that I saw the other day that may be related. The question is about years ago, my work for some years was about doing research on how to develop confidence, but other type of confidence in a scientific way. And one thing that I found that matches, I mean, that has an echo from what you were saying, is that what was found then is that one of the main ways to develop any type of confidence is practice. So I think it echoes the role that you have said about practice, that practice should develop confidence. And the question then, the short question is, what words you might have for those that are, like it's my case and Teresa, another one, that we are practicing without Sangha, without a teacher besides us. And we have to practice mainly on our own. So any word from that. And the sentence that I wanted to share from a movie that caught my attention is that it's about a priest, a troubled person that became a priest, a Catholic priest in the movie. And in one part, when he tried to explain why he was becoming a priest, he says something I found very interesting. He said, what happened is that people think that we are humans sometimes having a spiritual experience, when is the other way around. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. How do you think about that?
What's the name of the movie?
Fathers 2, Netflix.
Fathers
2.
2?
Stu, S-T-U.
Father Stu.
Yeah, like Stuart Stu.
And okay.
It's American, is based on a real story, actually. So good. It's interesting. Okay. But it caught my attention that he sent it. He said, we are not human beings sometimes having a spiritual experience. We're spiritual beings having a difficult, actually, I think he said, sometimes difficult human experience.
That's right. Sure. That's our understanding.
And what word would you say for practicing like some of us just by ourselves? I mean, we try, but we're by ourselves. What do you find there? Any advice or comments?
Well, from a very practical standpoint, I think it would be helpful to create a small piece of Kanando where you live or work. Make an altar, have a little statue, have some incense, have a candle, put in flowers every day, and just go to your It becomes your Buddha hall in Japanese monasteries, they have a Buddha hall. It's in addition to the Zendo, a Buddha hall where all the ceremonies take place. So you can create a small Buddha hall with a small altar that you visit every day. And maybe you want to have a little photo of Kanado on it, you know, or the picture of the sign, Kanado sign, on your altar, and you say, oh, that's, I'm home.
And what about the Sangha? I mean, thinking that the family first, I mean, taking care of the family, then the people you meet, then your clients or whatever.
Yeah.
They can become the Sangha.
Sure.
But you don't have the feedback from them to you. You don't have the conversation or the support in a Buddhist way from them to you. Mm. So it's a good practice in the sense of giving. That's a very good practice.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the sense of thinking they are stuck.
You can connect with Sangha members whenever you like. I think maybe we have time for one more question. We're getting close to time, but maybe if anybody has a question, one more. Yes, Teresa.
You said that when you built Kanondo, you didn't build it with the idea that I don't know how you said it exactly, but you didn't build it with the idea that you wanted to spread up Buddhism or more people to practice, and that would be the wrong understanding. There seems to be so much confusion in certain places where very important decisions are made. So I wonder if there was more clarity, if more people had this mind that you said, if more people saw the big picture, there will be less suffering probably. So why would it be wrong to build a temple with the idea more people will practice? Why is that wrong? It seems to me that if there was more people practicing, the world would be a better place. You don't have to call it Buddhism or anything, just.
So pretty.
Well, if we had that idea, that building Kanondo would have a great benefit and will achieve certain things. That's what Suzuki Roshi warned us about, not to have a gaining idea. You just do something because you feel it's right, without any idea of what benefit you may feel you have created. We have to be cautious of that, because that becomes a bit arrogant. Then we start to feel, look what I did, look what we did, aren't we wonderful? We just say, this is built and maybe people will come. So there are, you know, in the Zen literature, there are stories where a monk was living at a temple, and he was all alone, and he sat by himself every day in Zazen, and he did his meals by himself, just lived alone. And he took care of the temple without advertising, oh, you should come up the mountain and see me. Just here I am, doing what's right, doing what I feel is right. No expectations, no gaining idea. Some people may say, in this day and age, that's a crazy idea to do things without expecting gain or hoping for a gain. In the world we have today, that's crazy. But those of us that have come to this practice have come with a different kind of understanding. Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.